Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy week before the weird early recruiting day week.
Which has kind of quickly elevated into actual National Signing Day.
Yeah, it seems like it's going to be, I mean, it seems like anyone who's not really wavering plans on committing, I don't know about us specifically, but plans on, like, for nationally, it seems like most guys are probably going to send a sign on the dotted line. I've seen a couple bigger guys who are going to wait till February, but it definitely seems like it's going to be the bigger of the two, which is interesting because it kind of, like, we knew it was happening, but it wasn't, like, really for, pushed until the last couple weeks when a lot of the recruiting, the post regular season recruiting stuff has gone on, and then it's like, oh, this is gonna be a busy couple of days here.
Yeah, and like a busy couple of days in the middle of the holiday season. And you know what? At some point too, I feel like these recruits would rather just get on with deciding where they were gonna go and get on with their holiday season. I think a lot of recruits by the end of the process are pretty exhausted by it all and all the constant selling.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine. I totally get. Like, if you still have to make up your mind, I think that's you should take all the time you need. If you have to drag it out into April or May, it's a big deal. So, like, a couple of guys do that, and that's fine. But for most of these guys who, you know, they're pretty set in a school, obviously some flip every year, but you would think, like, hey, let me just get this over with so I don't have to hear from, you know, random Tosh X who happened to have a wide receiver spot pop up today, and they didn't really want me at any point during this whole thing, but now they're telling me they're, like, you know, they want me to come and, you know, who knows if I'll even play for them. You know, I can imagine that gets really exhausting, and being able to cut 2 months of it out is pretty, it is an advantage. So I'm a little surprised that this is going to, it's seemingly overtake the February signing day as much as it is, because usually, you know, there are guys who want to drag it out. But I think a lot of those guys like the pomp and circumstance of committing on signing day, so they might not even really need the extra months.
Right. Yeah, that's the thing. Like, the pomp and circumstance of it, you can still potentially have that pomp and circumstance from the December 20th to 22nd time frame. In general, I know we talked about this when the early signing day was first passed. This seems like a big advantage for schools like Syracuse and obviously us in particular, with, you know, keeping our coach this offseason, obviously a big leg up, especially against the teams that we normally recruit against. The fact that, you know, most players aren't really going to be there in the dead of winter is, I think, a big plus for us. Not that, like, they don't know it snows in Syracuse, but obviously, you know, the late December into, like, early February Syracuse winter is much different than the early December Syracuse winter most years. So obviously bringing kids in from Florida, Texas, wherever, obviously helps to have them in a little bit milder winter weather versus, again, those blizzard conditions. Also think in general, you know, teams like SU that have an ability to identify talent early, I think this puts a premium on that sort of, you know, faith and sort of, you know, belief from the beginning. And like you were alluding to earlier, like, you know, not having like an Ohio State or a Penn State or Alabama going, oh, well, now we have a wide receiver spot open, so let's just go offer this kid that Syracuse has had, you know, verbal for the last 6 months. Definitely changes a lot of that conversation, and does really help out SU and a lot of other schools in that kind of, you know, bottom third of the Power Five situation.
Yeah, it's definitely a big advantage for Syracuse, especially this year. I mean, it's actually a great year for it to happen for SU specifically, because this would probably end up, unless something crazy happens, which seems less and less likely as we get closer to this early signing day, this is going to be the best class we've had
a couple decades.
In, like, the internet era. Going back, I'd say, like, probably 2007, 08, 09 is like when those sites really started to become big. And this is easily the best class, I think, in that span of time. Going back, what, four head coaches back into the Coach P years? So, but like, I can imagine a situation where a guy like Tyrone Sampson, who to his credit has been, he doesn't seem to have wavered like one iota at all during this process. And he's our biggest recruit. He's from Detroit. Imagine, you know, Michigan loses a center commit to, you know, Ohio State or something, and they just go gung-ho on him. Now, you know, it seems like he's gotten overtures from big schools like that, and he hasn't wavered. But, you know, you could see a situation where a Detroit kid gets, you know, the full Monty from Jim Harbaugh for a month down the stretch, and he, you know, might flip. this makes it, assuming, I think he's a doctor who's going to sign in December.
Yeah.
For those kids, like, this makes that way less of a, you know, this, it's not going to happen. And also, it protects the kids who are at the back end of these recruiting classes, who you see so many of them with, you know, they end up getting cut from the classes, and, you know, you see them decommit, and you're like, oh, why would this kid leave this class when he, you know, this is clearly his best offer. A lot of the time, that's come from the coaches, like, basically trying to push them out of the class, saying, hey, so you might not actually have as much playing time when you get here. We, you know, recommend that you look elsewhere, or they'll just out and out rescind the offer, which is, you know, a shitty thing to do, but it is what it is. So it protects those kids who, most of that, like, you know, chicanery would happen in January and even, like, in the week up to the February signing day. So there are definitely pros and cons. It's not right for everyone. But I think for a program like Syracuse, which is more of the hunted than the hunter in a lot of these situations, and then obviously Syracuse ends up going down the list with, you know, into like the top AAC schools and taking guys from them, it protects like all those schools from the bottom up. So I think it's a pretty, I think it's a good thing. I think eventually you'll see it more even out as kids kind of learn the new, you know, how things work. I think coaches are definitely pressuring kids to sign early. What I will feel bad about, which I believe it was Greg McElroy predicted the other day on ESPN, you'll often see a lot of assistant coaching turnover right after signing day. He said that he thinks that December 21st, the day after the December signing day, is going to be the craziest day of assistant coaches getting fired of all time. And that is a thing that happens. It's gross. But head coaches will leave staff members in place that he knows that they know they're going to fire until the second that their recruits sign, and then they let them go. I don't think that's going to happen at Syracuse. It seems like we're probably going to keep the staff intact, for better or worse.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to keep. I don't think we're going to make any active changes. Doesn't mean the changes can't happen, but I don't see anybody going anywhere. I think our best recruiters are on the defensive end. The defense hasn't really looked that great.
The way the staff is formulated is interesting because the best recruiters are definitely on the defensive end when this is like clearly an offensive, defense has to be 50% of it, but the offense is clearly like the forward facing part of the program. And Babers is obviously an offensive guy, but Nick Monroe is, at least to my knowledge, clearly the number one recruiter on the staff. And the DBs, while they made improvements, weren't like, you know, crazy good this year. So it might behoove us to keep him around. And obviously, I don't think we were planning on letting anyone go because, you know, you have to weigh what happened early in the year versus what happened late in the year. And there definitely have to be changes to the scheme or to the approach. But overall, I think the staff will probably be largely intact.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, last year, I think we had two departures. One, Coach Kaufman, that was a surprise. But at the same time, like, it's kind of the product of the system in some ways where, you know, Babers kind of brings, in large part, his guys with him. It's not that these guys don't have any future prospects as you know, head coaches or getting bigger jobs. It's just that because they've kind of come together as a package deal for the last, like, 6 years now or so, there's not as much mobility. That's not a bad thing for them necessarily. It creates, you know, job stability and things that you don't normally have in a lot of, you know, Power 5 jobs. But, like, because of how play calling works, where it's like a three-man job, because of how the defense works, where it's definitely Brian Ward in charge, but then everybody else has, like, their really, you know, quality recruiting roles underneath that. There's enough mechanics in there that really stop anybody, at least I would think anybody else, from going somewhere. And like I said, like, Mike Hart was obviously the guy who if anyone could have left last year, would have. Kaufman, I think, saw himself as somebody kind of, you know, middle of the road that wasn't going to be able to have much mobility on the staff. So it made sense that he went elsewhere. But yeah, I think that, you know, Syracuse isn't necessarily in danger of that, like you said. What's going to be interesting, too, is if we do see that much turnover with coaches, how much it changes next year's approach for kids as well as programs. Because obviously, you know, kids talk, recruits from big schools will talk to kids kind of coming up in the next class and talk about different staffs and different campuses and tactics from different coaches. And I do think that if we see that sort of mass exodus you were referring to, you could see, right now they're estimating about 75% of kids are probably going to sign early. I think you might see that knock down towards 50 if if things go the way that people are projecting with assistance.
Yeah, I think you'll see it even out as we get farther along and we learn a little bit more how these two signing day periods work. Obviously, like, you have kind of, you have, you know, a different animal with basketball where there are multiple signing periods, but like the basketball recruiting just stretches out so long and there are very few flips. Football is very much its own animal, so we definitely need to get like a couple years in here to kind of figure out how this is going to go versus, like, you know, we've kind of settled into a rhythm of the regular February signing day and know exactly how that works out every year.
Oh, without a doubt. And yeah, I think this is going to be interesting. It's going to be informative for fans, informative for the kids, the coaching staffs, and us as writers. I know I wasn't until about a month ago planning to really be busy for this. Now I'm planning to be very busy. I'm sure you are as well, covering things from a national perspective.
Yeah, that's the day before I like go away for Christmas, so that's going to be a heck of a day.
Yeah, I'm luckily in Southern California for Christmas this year. Otherwise, travel thrown in there would not be ideal for me. But yeah, enough about our vacation plans. I guess we can talk about just kind of what's been going on with Syracuse's football roster over the last week or so. I know since the end of November, we've lost four players to transfer. Some of them not ideal, especially I'd say Caton Samuels, would you agree, is probably the most troublesome departure of those four?
Yeah, because he, you know, was a pretty decent player, and with, really with the trend with a lot of these guys are they're coming from positions of depth, positions that we don't have super great depth at, DB and defensive line. So it's not ideal. I don't begrudge any kid for leaving because at the end of the day they have to do what's right for them. But from the Syracuse perspective, I would say it's not great.
Yeah, definitely. I could deal with the DBs leaving if only because they weren't getting much playing time. And we have so many recruits coming in at those spots and guys who redshirted this year. I wasn't as worried, but I was a lot more worried about Samuels leaving because defensive tackle is just not a position we really have much depth at. We kind of moved Kenny Ruff over there. It seems like we moved Josh Black in there. We currently don't have any defensive linemen committed, which is worrying, and we only have three spots left, and I don't really see us making a huge push towards any high school level kids. Doesn't mean we can't make a JUCO or two addition, and if we do add any junior college players, I would assume we see those positions addressed more than anything else. But on the positive end of things, we have seen, you know, four players commit over, well, since last Friday, including three who were on campus this past weekend. So I think I'd like the momentum here. I don't think any of them were like these, you know, enormous names, but I think all of them filled really great, really big needs, and were kind of sleepers in the class. I think, you know, look at a guy like Dre Sisco, who's over at IMG Academy. Like, he's somebody who kind of, you know, sits as a sleeper. I think Carlos Vettorello too, who committed this week. I think he's another guy who he had offers from a lot of different places, like Oregon, Oregon State, Minnesota, bunch of other kind of, you know, bottom half of the Big Ten, Pac-12, all the MAC. A lot of different programs seem to be interested in him. It was great to get, you know, kind of our fifth offensive lineman and really have a strong class. I think, you know, this group is definitely, this is going to be like the 2015 class where we had four offensive linemen. I think this class, however, is going to be significantly better, if only because we have, you know, two blue chippers in there. While last time we had, you know, some great players like Cody Conway, Aaron Roberts was in that group. But the fact that we have, you know, two kind of four-star players in Kadir White and Tyrone Sampson, I think makes this year's offensive line class significantly better and really, really helps what Babers wants to do going forward on offense.
Yeah, it really seems like when Babers got here, he identified the O-line as, like, maybe the number one concern because they've been recruiting the hell out of the offensive line between last year's class and this year's. And then, obviously, this year we saw a lot of progression with that unit. So I think the future of the O-line is pretty bright. Obviously, getting a kid like Vettorello, we recruited Detroit very well in this
less few cycles. I mean, going way back is
Maroon did pretty well, and then Schaefer I don't remember as much, but it's been like a sneaky like hotbed for us because it kind of goes under the radar. Obviously Michigan State will look there, but it it doesn't get the same attention that like different Ohio towns get, or even like some of the, you know, even Chicago, I think, gets a little more attention. Detroit mm-hmm. produces some pretty good players.
Well, we've got now, I think, some solid pipelines at Cass Tech, over at Detroit Jesuit, like where Vettorello's from and where Paris Bennett went. Like, now we have these, kind of, you know, we've had, I think there's a Cass Tech kid in this year's class, too. We might have, like, three straight years of Cass Tech players.
I don't think we have a Cass Tech kid this year, but we get kids from there, like, every other year or so.
Yeah, I know Zach Morton was from there, and so was, I forgot who the other one was, but I'm sure.
You've been kids out of there since, like, Marone was here.
Yeah.
I remember, like, a handful.
Oh, and Tim Walton.
Yes, Tim Walton.
I was struggling because their names are so similar. But, yeah, I mean, I think Detroit's a great area for us. Michigan in general was a really big hotspot for us last cycle. This cycle, not as much, but this year's class is interesting just in terms of, you know, where they're coming from, where we've really focused our time and energy. Like I said, you know, five offensive linemen. In this one, we got four linebackers, three defensive backs, two running backs that we might be pursuing a third, which would be interesting. I'm not sure how that will go. And
we have shown like the willingness to kind of move people around too. So
right.
I think they're probably looking more towards just like athletes than, you know, aggressively targeting specific guys for running back. But
true.
Like, so I could see us taking a third running back with the knowledge that we might end up moving him to receiver or, you know, somewhere in the slot.
Although the third running back is a 4-star who's currently like locked in with USC.
Yeah, I mean, well, then he's probably running back.
Yeah, then he's probably...
he's probably whatever he wants to be. Yeah. He can be kid.
Play quarterback. I don't really care. speaking of quarterback, I guess we don't have a quarterback currently in the fold. Dan, do you think we're going to add one? I would think no.
You don't think the Boise State decommit might...
I had some thoughts about it, but I feel like BYU and Iowa, from everything I've read, have pushed pretty hard. And that's been kind of what... at least from what I've read, seems to be what created the decommit.
Okay, well, yeah, that was the only guy I could really think of. We haven't really aggressively gone after quarterbacks in this class.
Well, that's since the beginning of the class, anyway. Since about, I think we kind of gave up on that dream around like mid-July, August.
And honestly, I don't think it's a huge deal, because like, you know, you ideally, I think, like to take one every year, but. With DeVito redshirting, I think it, you know, you can get by without a quarterback in this class. You can probably take two next year, the year after, and make up for it.
Yeah, and I'm completely fine with that. And I kind of, you know, I said that in a couple of the recruiting articles lately. I've said that on Twitter as well. Like, it'd be nice to have a quarterback, but I don't want to waste a roster spot. I mean, we saw that with some players, you know, on the roster of just, yeah, it would have been great to have, like, Mahoney's an interesting case, a weird case, but like, if we were going to end up going with Culpepper for the most part as Dungy's primary backup this year, no, it didn't hurt anything at the end of the day, but having a scholarship tied up in a player who might not necessarily play much, if at all, especially when you like willingly kind of opt into that situation with a couple years to go in his career, definitely doesn't help build depth and doesn't necessarily... you know, translate to, I guess, the sort of quarterback depth that you'd be looking for in particular. And I'm just talking about the quarterback position here more than anything else. I think that, you know, because a couple guys were saying in the comments and stuff that, you know, we really need a quarterback, and I just don't buy it. I think that, you know, taking up a roster spot with a guy who's maybe like a low 3-star at this point, because you and I have talked about this for years now, especially once like we were in on the conversation with DeVito, is there's not as much change in terms of quarterbacks and where they're committed to, so there's really little point to going after, really trying to flip guys, because especially, you know, some of the top guys, because you're not probably not going to do it no matter who you are. Most teams only take one quarterback per cycle. Quarterbacks all talk to each other. They probably all at Elite 11 and other, you know, camps like that. All these guys know where the other ones are going, and all of them know, want to know that they're the number one option for the school they're going to. So unless we get, you know, maybe I know there's that that one 4-star kid who a couple SU staffers followed from Arkansas. I saw he's still out there, and there's a couple other blue chippers still out there. But based on what we know of Babers, I don't necessarily think that he'd be one to sign up for another dual threat after the Eric Dungy experience.
Yeah, if you're SU, I think if there's a blue chip kid that you really think you can get without like really throwing like, you know, wasting a ton of time on him, I think you go for it. But overall, I'm not overly concerned about missing a quarterback in this class. The only spot where it could become an issue is if, you know, we have senior Dungy this year. It sounds like Culpepper will still be here, which is good. I think he's very serviceable. I think if Culpepper decides to leave for his senior year, and then you only have Dungy and potentially, what, like two freshmen behind him or whatever, that could be a tricky spot.
Yeah, I mean...
DeVito. I meant DeVito, not Dungy.
That's what I figured. I mean, I could be fine with it. I think that... I mean, yeah, ideally, if you don't... I think you bank on Culpepper staying for now, just because there's no telling what happens for his career or DeVito's yet.
That's true. There's no, like, guarantee that DeVito to stay. I mean, we all assume everything we've heard about him is great.
Looks
but there's
good.
No guarantee he steps right in and starts as a redshirt sophomore. Like, I think that'll probably happen, but you can't bank on it. And I think Culpepper showed enough where, like, if he made strides, I wouldn't be, like, too concerned if the staff was like, no, he's the best guy right now.
Although I saw that video of DeVito the other night.
Oh, he was dropping some dimes.
But it's still practice, yeah, but that downfield accuracy is like nothing to scoff at.
And that's what we saw from him as a recruit. Like that's right. You know what everyone got super excited about. That's why he was what number two in the Elite 11. Kid can throw it. Like he's probably the best pure passer we've had here. Who even knows since when? Like because you know most of our great quarterbacks were more dual threat guys, option guys. I guess dual threat wasn't really a thing. They were like option-based quarterbacks who could throw the ball downfield.
Right.
Yeah, DeVito might be like the best pure passer we've had in a long time. Now, that doesn't always translate. You see guys in the NFL with like giant arms that are terrible. But, you know, the kid has a pretty good resume behind him. So I'm excited to see what he can do come spring, and hopefully we can get him some time next year.
Yeah, I mean, I remember because I saw him down here at the Elite 11 like regional event in L.A., and I mean, he won the accuracy contest that day, but I think he even looked better in that video. And I'm sure, you know, spending a year at this point with the college training and conditioning staff and the coaching staff there has only made him better. I agree with you. I think that we probably end up seeing DeVito, as the primary backup next year and then the starter for 2019. But, that's not to sell Rex Culpepper short. I think if for 2019, we end up with the two of them and a true freshman, and then, you know, the true freshman's in case of emergency break glass guy. And then we also have Clayton Welch, who's the walk-on sitting around if need be. I'm fine with all that. I'm not going to get too worked up about QB depth when we're doing such a great job addressing the offensive line, which I think is what was our biggest problem with QB depth in recent years.
Yeah, I think that's legit. And obviously you can't, like, just guarantee that you're going to they're going to, you know, have this perfect quarterback situation every year. I think Syracuse had a really good one this year, and we needed it because of injuries and obviously the, you know, the Dungy injury and then wanting to see what we had at Culpepper, but, you know, after a couple of your games with Mahoney. But overall, I'm not going to freak out about not getting it.
Same here. So, Dan, if you had to guess, right now this class I think is, what, 37, 38 according to
37 and 7th in the ECC.
I will take that.
I would sign for that right now.
Every single year. At least until we keep winning, and then in that case, I want more. Because that's how fandom works. Dan, where do you think we finish up?
I, without looking at like the teams just ahead of us, I know there are some. Like Alabama is up to 9 now, but they only have 14 commits. There are a couple other teams like that are... I'm sure lurking right behind us that only have a couple of commits right now. Florida State only has 9, and I'm sure Willie Taggart's going to go crazy over the next couple of weeks.
Coach every single player from the Oregon recruiting staff.
He's going to take, like, I think they had 3 or 4 Florida kids. I would bet three of them end up at Florida State, if not all 4. Tennessee, who knows with Pruitt, but he had a big commit today. He only has 11 kids. He's behind us. Iowa only has 14. They don't really recruit at like a crazy different level than we do.
Right.
But there are a couple of schools, so I think we'll end up sliding a little bit. But I think I find it hard to think we won't finish at least in like the low 40s, which is such a big step forward for where this program was, where every year, even when we seem like we were building a pretty, you know, class that would be around where we are now, we'd end up sliding into, like, the, you know, at best, like, the 52, 53 range. I'd be surprised if we were below, like, 42 or 43 at this point. And there's a chance if we land one of these, like, the mid-late guys that we're targeting, who knows if we get any of them, but... or if, you know, you just fill the class with three more solid, like, three-star guys, you know, we could hang around and be around 37, 38 at the end, which is, again, just a tremendous, tremendous step forward.
Well, also super impressive when we wouldn't even have – it wouldn't be, you know, a volume-based
not volume-based at all. And coming off of, like, two mediocre years out of context and a pretty disappointing finish. Like, there wasn't a lot working for us here. This was just the staff did a really good job without being aided by much.
Yeah, and I mean, I think everyone bought in. You saw the last two weekends. The first weekend of December, they had, like, a lot of the, you know, locked-in kids plus Dre Sisco and I think maybe one or two other, uncommitted guys. But in with Sampson, Kadir White, I think Anthony Quealy, a couple of the other kids were all in there, which I thought was a great tactic to help sell the program a little bit. Then this past weekend, I think they had a couple of the other committed kids, plus a lot of non-committed, and like we mentioned, three of them ended up verbally committing between the weekend and Monday. So I don't know what the schedule looks like the rest of December. I would assume we're probably past official visits at this point. But
There's some kids that are taking final official visits like this coming weekend. I don't know if any are coming to Syracuse, right. But... there are some kids who are making, like, last-minute official visits if they're, you know, before they decide on the 20th. And also, 24/7, like, that was their composite ranking. Their, like, regular, just their rankings that isn't combined with Stout and Rivals and ESPN has us up at 30th. They're very high on our players. I think our only composite four-star guy is Tyrone Sampson, but I'm pretty sure 24/7 has both Tadir White and Trillian Williams at four stars on their own rankings.
But then not Sampson.
Then they don't have to say, which is weird. But either way, like, so there's a little bit of variance, but overall, like, this is just a very, very impressive class and very excited to hopefully get almost all of them signed on the 20th.
Agreed.
A week from today.
I know we're already getting the posts done about all of those guys this week, so we can have that ready to go. I'm going to switch focus to beer, and then we can talk Georgetown, which is probably what a lot of people are here to listen about.
Cool. I actually had some new stuff this week. I said last week I had some craft stuff lying around in my fridge, and I've gotten to most of it, all from the Farmhouse Brewing in brewery in Owego, which I had not had before this, like, haul of stuff I picked up, / was brought by a friend who went up there. But basically their thing is that they use, like, local farmed, like, vegetables and stuff to make pretty interesting beers. The first one I had was the Cuke Skywalker. I guess pretty appropriate for this weekend, which is a cucumber goza sour, which was really tasty. I mean, I, you know, find it hard to not like a good sour. This one, like, you could really tell the cucumber flavor was there, but it actually kind of helps that it's not, like, a super aggressive flavor. I think it worked well. Super drinkable, really enjoyed it. Really refreshing. Then I had their Mama Maple Llama, which is, I believe, a stout. No, it might have been a porter. No, it's a porter. I had this the other night. Didn't get, like, a ton of the maple notes in there. Admittedly, when I had it, it had already been cracked, and it probably wasn't the most fresh, so I don't want to, like, totally not give it its due. It was definitely very boozy, at, like, 10.2%, you could tell. I'm also not a huge porter drinker, but, you know, it was pretty good. I don't generally love porters, and this wasn't, like, a ton different, but, I also should probably try to get it fresher next time. And then tonight I am currently drinking their tomato basil saison. And admittedly, I don't get a lot of the tomato or the basil. But it's just a really good saison without that. Like, it just, it's super, I almost get more, like, clovey, like, kind of like what you get from, like, a Belgian white more than anything else. But it's, like, it's really good outside of, like, maybe not nailing the flavors they were going for.
Interesting. I've had a basil saison from, I think, at Full Steam down in Durham, in the Durham area. But I don't think Tomato basil sounds a bit aggressive, but if it doesn't taste like it, I guess I'm a little less averse.
Yeah, if you told me this was just like a say, I mean, I didn't really like grade it out any differently. It just tastes really good. But if you had just told me this was like regular Saison, I would be like, yep, this is a good Saison.
Fair enough. On my end, didn't have a lot of different stuff. Had a fat tire. I went up to the mountains over the weekend, so I had Sierra Nevada's holiday variety pack that they created. So I had their holiday haze IPA, which is really just a hazy version of Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, in my opinion. Had their winter tide, kind of like spiced winter warmer that they made. Went over to Big Bear Mountain Brewing, had their Little Beaver IPA. And then I had just Sierra Nevada Pale Ale. So nothing crazy. Pretty subdued weekend for me. I don't know what's the deal lately. I guess I just I have not been as adventurous as I normally am.
Yeah, I'm not sure when the next time we'll do this. I hopefully we can have like a post-signing day show at some point. I'll be down in Atlanta from Thursday to Tuesday. So if we don't speak before I go down there, hopefully we'll have some Southern beers to report back on whenever we speak next, unless it is next Wednesday, in which case I will still be up here.
Fair enough either way. I'll be in Orange County, so I will... Well, I won't be next week either yet, so just really depends on what I drink this weekend. I got a half fridge full of stuff and plan on going out at least one night this weekend, so probably end up adding something to the old untapped list.
Good. So I think that's a big problem for me. I've hit like a lot of the resources where I usually get new stuff a lot, so I just haven't run into as many new things. But hopefully, you know, we'll be able to rectify the situation going forward.
Fair. Yeah, I'm not sure how much new beer the next like month or two are going to bring for me between just the holidays. Like, if you're not like hanging out with friends much, you're not really going to see a ton of new beers. I usually just bring my own to family gatherings. Then in January, I'm going to be in Italy for a little bit. And they actually do have a burgeoning beer scene, but we'll see how much of it's like rave worthy.
Yeah. Also, I feel like in Italy, like you just have to drink wine. So.
Oh, that's what my wife thinks. I already told her. I already scouted out a couple breweries.
I'm interested to hear. Just I've never heard anything about Italian beer, but.
You know what? Aaron actually has some good things to say about like some of their IPAs. I'm not like going to be like actively searching for stuff. It's just more. I ID'd a beer bar near our hotel in Rome, and another couple near our hotel in Florence. And I know a couple breweries of like that have stuff that's supposed to be good. So again, we'll see what comes of that. I might just end up drinking wine if the early parts of the trip aren't really yielding any quality beer.
Fair. I'm super curious to see what you find.
Yeah, I will have a report in late January. Anyway, Dan, we're facing Georgetown on Saturday. This used to be more important. Now it doesn't really feel like it matters.
I will say, and this is the last bit of credit I'm going to give Georgetown on anything today. Georgetown's really pushing for this to be like important, and I appreciate that.
They are
way more into it than we are, and I don't think that speaks great of us. We just have a lot more stuff going on, and this is the first game they've had this year. They're 0-0. They have not played any teams that have a player over 6'3". They're flirting with like the worst RPI. That's not true. I assume they have. But they're legitimately, they're 8-0, but they are still somehow flirting with, like, one of the worst RPIs in all of college basketball, despite being undefeated, which is all you need to know about the schedule that Georgetown put together. And honestly, considering that they did this intentionally, I'm almost impressed by how well they hit their objective.
I mean, we've talked about this a little bit before. This is utter garbage.
I'm looking at the, now I know way too many. All right, so it's actually not that crazy. I can name all 8 schools just based on the 3-letter like abbreviations. I thought at first I might not be able to get JAC, but I had it right. It was Jacksonville. Let's just go through the schedule here. Jacksonville, Mount St. Mary's, Maryland Eastern Shore, the daring road trip to Richmond, where they won by six, and then Maine, Coppin State, Howard, and North Carolina A&T.
So that is an all-star non-conference schedule.
Some of those teams are so bad that we have not talked about them in our now weekly segment of talking about low major teams for no reason that no one's interested in.
Probably not. Also,
I don't think you've brought up any of these schools.
do they not have enough non-conference games?
They still have North Texas. They have Alabama A&M. Then they have well, no. Then that's it. I think
Do they like forget to schedule enough non-conference
they
games?
just stopped. They couldn't find any more RPI plus 300 teams and just stopped.
No, because this only gets them to 11, and they have 18 Big East games.
The Big East didn't bump up to like to the Big Ten did, right? The Big Ten's up to they added an extra
I
game
think
or
the
two.
Big Ten's up to 20. I mean, we'll be up to 20 in a couple of years. But yeah, I mean, I don't know what. Like, for them, there's only 10 teams, so it makes sense to just do the round robin, well, the double round robin with 18 games. So I don't really understand why they only
I
scheduled
get,
11 non-conference games.
yeah, we've talked about this before. I get what they were doing. They wanted to ease Patrick Ewing in, and they probably saw what happened with like Chris Mullin in his first year. Aside from beating us, it was really ugly. And St. John's is just starting to turn around now. So I get they wanted to get Patrick Ewing like his sea legs. I totally understand that. We've thought, coming from the perspective that we have with the football program, which obviously the two sports are very different and the schedule's very different. But that being said, they basically made it so hard for them to even like sniff the NCAA tournament unless they go crazy in the Big East. Like, you would think they would have scheduled like one more decent game.
Yeah, or just like actually filled out the rest of your non-conference schedule.
Yeah,
Because
or yeah, finish the schedule. Like,
you're
they've
missing
done
two
like
games.
they basically punted on any chance of the NCAA tournament unless they like win the Big East tournament or finish like top three in the Big East, which based on what they scheduled, I don't think they have a lot of confidence in that. I don't think they think they're very good.
No, like
And who knows? I can't tell you what Georgetown is.
this could honestly be like a 19-win team that doesn't even sniff an at-large bid.
This would be a 19-win team that doesn't make the NIT.
Right.
I don't know how I mean, NIT might just bring them because they're a name,
Right.
but like, man, like, and again, this isn't even like trying to shit on Georgetown for that, for being Georgetown.
Just looking
Like,
realistically at like what their prospects are.
if anything, like if this was anybody, this is hilarious. And this is like they backed out of the PK80, which was like the most aggressive part of this whole thing. Like literally, their second biggest non-conference game is at Richmond, and I'm shocked they did that and they won by six. So good for them. I don't even know if Richmond's good this year. They're occasionally good.
I don't think they are. I think they're actually pretty bad.
Actually, they were 1-5 when they played. Richmond is now
2-8.
2-8 with their wins over UAB, Go Blazers, and James Madison by three.
Dude. They've lost to UL Lafayette this year and Jacksonville State by
Oh my
33.
God.
Good
They got
Lord. Richmond is
trounced
bad.
by Cincinnati. They got beat by Vermont. They got destroyed by what looks like a pretty bad Wake Forest team. They got beat by 19 by ODU, which I don't even know. I couldn't tell you if I've ever seen an ODU basketball game. Oh man. So Richmond's terrible, which they're not always, but they are this year. And Georgetown happened to find them as like their 1 A-10 team.
And only won by six.
And won by six.
I think winning this game might hurt our RPI.
Can we ditch this game? Can we get rid of it? Can we just
Actually,
not show up?
I actually joked with Andrew over at a Casual Hoya when I was answering their Q&A this week. I was like, "This game is stupid. Like, I don't. This game doesn't do anything for us right now. Like." If you guys get better down the road, sure, like this game becomes relevant again. But if Georgetown is going to be this deplorable, either from a optics standpoint or a pure resume standpoint, like this game only serves to hurt us.
Yeah, like the Syracuse fan of me wants Georgetown to like lose every Big East game, but then they're legitimately going to be one of the worst teams on our
Right.
ledger, and we're gonna, I think right now we're looking at like a flirting with an NCAA tournament bid type year, assuming we don't get a lot better during the course of the year, which should happen. But right now, I'd say we're like probably a bubble team, based on like how the team's looked
Yeah, we're like a 10
and how,
seed.
yeah, which I think we all. Thought that would be a pretty decent thing for us going in. So having this like Georgetown weight around our neck that was because it's our historic rival, and we want to play them, and we want to play them every year. It's good to keep it going. I'm a big fan that we're playing all these teams from the Big East. But man, like Georgetown, you got to meet us halfway a little bit. Like, you can't be this.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see what quote unquote this entails.
And then hopefully that doesn't mean they're going to beat us. That would be so embarrassing.
That would be the worst. For those listening, you've probably seen the article already. I have it scheduled right now, though, Wednesday night. Just talking about everything Georgetown's doing to get people to come to this game. And if you look around Ticketmaster, there's just so many tickets left. Like ridiculous amounts of tickets left. If you're in the D.C. area or literally anywhere near D.C., Northern Virginia, or Maryland, just go to this game. There is no one going to this game. It ends up that starting 8-0 against a bunch of scrubs does not get anyone in the door for Georgetown basketball.
Well, to be fair, people did door that no one was getting in the door for Georgetown basketball to begin with. Like, the basketball program doesn't draw unless we're going.
This is true. But yeah,
Syracuse is the biggest draw for Georgetown basketball.
It is. They're giving away, looks like, 100 onesies for the toddler Georgetown fan in training for you, if you wanted to threaten your children with Georgetown.
Well, toddlers can't grasp like intricate metrics like RPI
or failure.
Or failure. They don't know well enough yet.
Yeah, so there's that. I saw that they are not serving orange products in the lunch halls.
I actually kind of love that.
That's actually clever.
It's super clever. They're not serving orange juice in like the dining hall for a week, which if I'm a normal Georgetown student, which means I don't give a crap about this basketball team, and I like orange juice, I'm like kind of annoyed.
I am livid.
But as a sports fan, even though it is my rival team, I appreciate this move.
Yeah, I respect it. They also are offering a chance for donations with your ticket to win a jersey autographed by the Bulldog, which is...
Who cares? Well, who wants Jack? Is it the actual dog or the mascot?
No, the actual dog.
All right, that's better.
I mean, is it, though?
It's a pop. I'd rather have the actual dog than the stupid...
I'd rather... Just how about the Hall of Fame player who's your goddamn coach?
Yeah, or you could do that. That would make sense. Or go find Allen Iverson at like a casino somewhere. Like, you can make this happen.
I'm sure Big John's lurking somewhere on campus.
He definitely is. Big John's always lurking. That's all he does. Big John's only lurked for years.
Like, just have Big John sign 10 towels and then like just give those away to whoever donates the most money with their ticket. Like,
when I was like a sophomore at Syracuse and we tried to do this like Otto's Army point system the first time that no one knew about, and like we didn't market it nearly well enough and it was kind of a failure, we got such better prizes than this for a thing that didn't work. Like, we got like autographed Floyd Little stuff.
You got
Jack the Bulldog to step on some ink. Cool.
I doubt they even do it. They probably just have a paw print like stamp.
Probably. And yeah, and meanwhile, like, the whole reason that we're even doing all this is that your head coach is Patrick Ewing, who, you know, good for you giving him the job. Like, yeah, have him sign some stuff. He has to.
Yeah, this doesn't really seem that hard. The one reason people might actually show up, though, has nothing to do with Georgetown. Ends up that Red Panda is going to be there now.
That's the best thing they've done.
Yeah, that's the best thing they've done. As I joked on Twitter, Georgetown is now the third most talented group that will be on the that will be on the court.
To be fair, Red Panda might be number one.
Red
I don't
Panda
know how
probably
bullish
is number
on this
one.
Basketball team, I am.
I
think we're probably okay, but Red Panda's just so good.
Red Panda. I've seen Red Panda a couple times because I've just lucked out at a couple different both Warriors and either Clippers or Kings. I think no Clippers. There's no way she did it on the ice. But yeah, I think I've lucked out at least two Warriors and or Clippers games.
I think I've seen her twice. I think I've seen her. I think she did a Big East tournament game once that I was at that SC was in, and then I think I was covering UConn Cincinnati maybe or UConn Providence at the Xcel Center a couple years ago, and I think she did that. It's mesmerizing. She's amazing.
Like, right.
I know it's like become like she's almost turned into like Little Sebastian from Parks and Rec whenever she does a game and people on Twitter freak out, but like she's amazing. She's just so good at her craft.
Yeah, I...
When, didn't she retire a couple years ago and people lost their minds and then she unretired?
Maybe.
I think that happened. I can't remember fully.
I have much respect for Red Panda. But yeah, they... you know who else seems pretty thirsty about this rivalry? The Big East Twitter handle.
Oh, I haven't seen that. I don't follow the Big East Twitter handle.
I don't either, but I was...
I don't follow any mid-major Twitter handles.
Why would you? Actually, no, I do follow the Mac. because
no, Matt's fun.
Because they're fun, and a bunch of their media relations people actually follow me.
Also, I just said that completely, like, I wasn't even trying to, you know, I was completely ignoring the fact that we do a preview for, like, every major college football conference every single year, and that I watch, like, a lot of those games. So that was just, that was off-brand for me, and it wasn't even, like, a, well, just poor job by me. But no, I don't follow Big East. And yes, it is a mid-major.
Yeah, they've been all over the BeatQ's hashtags. It's like, they're considering this, like, a conference victory thing. Like, they're really still jilted by this whole ACC thing.
Why, that we made the most obvious move possible?
Yeah, like the only move that made sense for a school that also plays football.
You mad at Miami? Like, we didn't start this.
Yeah, we didn't. Actually, you wouldn't get really mad. You'd blame SEC back in 1992.
Yeah, blame Arkansas and South Carolina.
Yeah, get pissed at them. Let's talk about this actual game, though, instead of just like the all the nonsense around it for us from a fan perspective. I don't really know what to make of Georgetown as a team, like from player perspective, because they face so many like really terrible opponents. I'm assuming that Jesse Govan is actually good. I don't know how good.
He's putting up huge numbers. So yeah,
20.6 points per game, 13 rebounds. Those are big numbers. He's hitting. He hasn't really shot a lot of threes, but he's hit 7 of 12.
It's enough where you can't leave him alone.
But like that's the case. That's the problem. Like I brought this up on the like brief preview thing I did. Like that's really the case with all of these guys. Like the first six guys in the rotation, all of them have taken at least 12, you know, at least 11 threes, and everybody's hit something between 32% and 58% of them, which is like terrifying.
Again, like they've played such a ridiculous schedule that.
And Govan's been 5 inches taller than anybody on any opposing team.
Pretty much. Like, it's just impossible to know how good they are. And they might be pretty decent. Who knows? We'll find out. And we, you know, clearly based on the Colgate game, like, we could easily just play down to them and then we still won't know. But you want to give them the benefit of the doubt and assume they're not terrible. But there's a reason they made the schedule. It's because they didn't have a lot of faith in this roster. So I assume Govan's pretty good. Derrickson, Johnson, they basically have 7 guys that play every game. It's between 17 and 31 minutes. So it's not a huge rotation. It's not really anything different than what Syracuse is doing. They're pretty long, I will say. Like Caleb Johnson, I think is 6'6 at the dart spot. I was looking at these before, and now I'm opening individual tabs, which is not the most efficient way to do this. Marcus Derrickson, 6'7. So like they have some length, which maybe will bother us a bit, but we're not a very good shooting team as is. So I don't know if it actually will have that giant an impact. Overall, like, I don't know, it's really hard to evaluate this team because they just haven't given us, like, much to go on here.
Yeah, they haven't given us much to go on. There's just a lot of, there's too many questions. Obviously, the fact that, like, they're a bigger team that,
it looks like everyone in the rotation, like, at least, like, 6'4". So that's a pretty big team.
Yeah, they're a bigger team, but they've also faced so many smaller teams. That, like, I mean, it's the same thing with some of SU's earlier numbers. That obviously aren't going to translate. But the one thing that has translated for SU has been rebounds. No matter who we face.
And Syracuse is still bigger than Georgetown.
Yeah, and Syracuse is still significantly bigger than Georgetown and everybody from a size perspective. We are the tallest team in the country, which is pretty cool. I'd say I'm pleased with that. And I'm pleased with it because we're seeing the results. If we weren't seeing results... indicative of being the tallest team in the country, I would definitely be much less thrilled about that fact. But anyway, I think they're going to give us some fits early because I think they're going to try to shoot threes as many opponents have this year, just to see kind of like how much they can extend the zone and what the zone can actually defend. Obviously, teams have really, you know, the Messiah, Jack Ferguson, as we predicted, went off last week. And
that was, I forgot about that. We predicted it, and, like, it was, you know, obviously this isn't the first or second or third time this has happened, but, like, it was kind of tongue-in-cheek, you know, we didn't expect him to go off for, what, like, 26 points or whatever it was. Like, I assume that he would probably hit some threes because this always happens, but come on. Like, really?
Yeah, it's like Jack Ferguson gets so mad about the jokes that he just decided he was going to punish us. And yeah, he if he was able to do that, I feel like Georgetown's definitely going to try to do similar things, extend the zone a little bit, jack up some threes. Again, it's hard to say because most of these guys have a lower volume of shots, how adept they really are as three-point shooters. I would probably keep an eye on Caleb Johnson most of all, though Jamarco Pickett seems like he's a volume guy, just not hitting right now, and that could potentially come and bite us. He's 12-37. He's taken the most threes by six on the team. Javon Blair has also taken 31. So the two players that have taken more than 30 threes. And they are not hitting at a rate that you would usually want volume three-point shooters to take. But hopefully, again, that SU's length, which is significantly more than any opponent they face so far, is able to shut that sort of thing down. I think if we can... I think we kind of have to choose one. It's either you, you know, stop Govan and get beat from three, or you let Govan beat you and you defend the three. I don't necessarily think this team's capable of stopping both tactics for Georgetown.
Yeah, I would probably rather not just let them have whatever they want from three, even if we're not totally sure on how well they'll shoot the ball, just because like that's how you get, you know, you have a couple minutes where you are lax defending the three and you find yourself behind by 12 versus like we've seen Syracuse go up like huge totals to centers before and be fine. So, and we do have to like, I don't know if, do we know what Sidibe's status is going to be? I know he's,
I don't know, but I really hope that he's like, I would be fine as long as like, as long as the game isn't like in the balance in the second half, I'd be fine with not seeing him on Saturday and just having him heal up for ACC play.
Yeah, I'm just a little worried about Shukru getting in foul trouble,
which
will probably happen no matter what. But if we had both of those guys to throw at Jovan, I would feel a little better about it because I think they're both pretty competent defenders, and that could give him problems, and we wouldn't have to like worry about crashing the zone as much. So that'll be something to watch out for. It seems like his injury's not like that bad, but they are being relatively cautious about it now because he seemed to have aggravated it in that UConn game after what game was before that he left early?
Kansas.
Was it Kansas that he didn't he originally hurt it in?
I thought it was Kansas.
Yeah, so the thing I'm looking at now, the big question is obviously Patrick Ewing's a first time head coach and he's coming from the NBA where he didn't face a lot of, if any, zone defense. His staff is interesting, most notably because Lewis Orr is his like main assistant, who obviously is a Syracuse guy, playing, you know, coaching in enemy territory here. He also served as an assistant under Boeheim and from 96 to 2000, which is like right when we made the big switch over to the zone. That 96 team is like the Final Four team that really made the zone like the signature thing, and he was a first-year assistant on that team. And then I don't know how much he coached against us at Bowling Green or at Siena, but he was the head coach at Seton Hall for years while we were Big East rivals with them. So he definitely has some experience against the Syracuse zone and coaching the Syracuse zone. So while I don't know how much hands-on stuff that Ewing himself is doing, or is probably a pretty valuable resource for Georgetown attacking the defense. And obviously the zone changes from year to year, and he hasn't faced it in a while, but... that's definitely an interesting part of this game. I kind of forgot he was on that staff until today.
Yeah, same. I mean, it's definitely an advantage for them to have anybody with experience in the zone, even if it was not the same exact zone. I think it's changed over time a little bit, but having quote unquote an expert kind of on staff and being able to at least help you simulate some of those elements, other than just the typical nonsense that we hear like once a year of. How to simulate the zone. We just had brooms.
A year slash like every ESPN broadcast at some point.
Just like clips of people just using brooms. I think Orr could help them bring this game a little bit closer than maybe we'd like because I think they might be a little bit better prepared for the zone than we've seen from any non-conference opponent.
They also certainly haven't had a lot else to prep for these other teams they've played.
So they've been prepping for this game since February.
Working on the zone for like months, and we, that's possible. Like they might have been drilling the zone attacking his own defense like since Ewing got there.
I would doubt
knowing
that for
this
a
would be the
second.
first actual big game they have.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt that for a second. Dan, if you had to give a prediction in this one, what are you thinking?
All right, well, since Syracuse can only score 72 points, that is their season average, and that's the score that Syracuse has had in its last four wins, I can't say that we won't score 72 points in this game. I don't think Georgetown is... I assume they're not that good. We actually don't really know. I do think they'll get up for the game. I'll take Syracuse winning 72-61 and it being probably closer than we like.
Well, if you think that's closer than we like, then just wait till you hear my prediction.
Oh, God.
I think that Govan's going to give us some fits. I think they're going to hit some threes in the early part of the game before cooling off later. I do think that they're going to be able to figure out the zone a little bit early, and then it's going to take some time for SU to kind of right itself. That said, as long as, you know, Tyus Battle's not jacking up threes for no reason, and everybody else isn't joining him in the brick lane party, and we're driving the lane, forcing Georgetown X to play some interior defense, I think SU wins. I see us winning 68-62. In an ugly game that will remind a lot of people of the old Big East when Patrick Ewing would roam the court for Georgetown.
I'm now trying to, I'm in an effort to just annoy myself and looking up what our best 3-point shooting percentage as a team is for a game this year, because it can't be over 40%, right? Like,
there's no way.
We're terrible every single. I don't want to like hold us on the line for this, but like I'm now going through. 33% against Iona. It's really bad.
Well, we're just like, if we just stop throwing threes, like take the open shot if you're Tyus Battle or like maybe
Howard maybe Brissett.
Like, but everybody else just like stop it.
Yeah, until you prove that, and I know that like part of it's like how are you gonna prove you can shoot them until you do it, but like I doubt they're really knocking them down in practice. I know Baham said Brissett is, so I'm okay with Brissett working on it because like he, you know, him adding a 3-pointer is important for his development,
right,
and for like defenses having to respect him from out there. And his shot looks fine, so I'm not worried about that. Yeah, we haven't even been. I think the closest I've gotten so far was against Texas Southern. We hit like 37%. I'm still looking.
Well, like the problem is like all the like shooting too many threes is derailing games that should be like well, you know, decided.
That's the other thing. It's like we're shooting a lot of them.
And we're shooting them like, at like the worst times.
Yeah, we're 18. Every game's in like the mid to high teens, if not like the low 20s. And that's just too many. This team can't hit them. Like, I know this is like modern basketball. I get that. I love 3-point shooting. I would love us to be a 40% 3-point shooting team and for us to take more threes than twos. I'm all with it. This is not the team for this. Like, this team shoots under 30% about half the time. I'm out of the Tollgate game. Whole day we were 36%, which is one of our best outings. 7-for-19. If we were 7-for-19 every game, I'd be okay. We're not. We're shooting like we were 25% in the UConn game. We almost died out of it from that. There were a couple others where like these games have been way too close as we've gotten out of our like out of our depth on the offensive side. So just stick with what we're good at. Let Tyus take us off the dribble. Let Howard dribble drive. Let Brissett like take advantage of matchups. Try to get the ball to the big guys like once in a while when they get a weird matchup on them. But like this is going to be Battle, Brissett, and Howard. Those are the three guys. Let them do their thing. Do not force shots. Hopefully we can start to like understand our strengths a little better, because that has been probably the most frustrating thing about this team. The defense has been mostly very good. Some lapses here and there, but they did a lot of steals. They're pretty fun to watch from that end. They rebound really well. The basketball IQ on the offensive end just goes into weird spurts of just like inanity, and I really hope that we can start to solve that as we get closer to the ACC.
I would agree. Definitely not ideal, and something, yeah, maybe we work out against Georgetown. Who knows? We have that.
Yeah, if we want to go hit like 50% of our threes and bomb Georgetown out of the gym, I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
Although, I don't expect it.
Yeah, although let's not test the theory then.
Yeah, let it happen naturally.
Right. All right, before we go, I wanted to check in on our friends in the low major department.
Ooh.
So, first...
I'm trying to remember who we settled on.
It was LAU, Brooklyn. LAU, Brooklyn, UC Irvine, and it was Loyola Chicago.
Yes, we covered the three, like, three-thirds of the country.
Yeah, we figured that was a good group. Since last week, UC Irvine has lost by 3 to Utah State, at Utah State, which actually isn't that bad. Then they lost to UT Rio Grande Valley by 14. So weird that they were able to test Utah State, but then get destroyed by Rio Grande Valley. They've got a few more non-conference games left before Big West play starts. They're facing, they actually had 4 straight home away games in here. They're at St. Mary's on Saturday, then they're at Montana, and then they'll host Idaho and New Mexico. Actually, no, Idaho's a neutral game. So Idaho, New Mexico, and then they'll jump into Big West play in the new year against UC Davis.
Very nice. LAU Brooklyn, unfortunately, their only game since we last spoke was against the Fairfield Stags, and they lost 76-72. So not looking like your normal LAU Brooklyn Blackbirds. I really wish they had hired Larry Brown, which was a thing that was being considered, apparently.
I forgot all about Larry Brown.
Yeah, apparently he interviewed for this job.
That's not surprising, I guess, because he's literally coached everywhere, and
I was really hoping it would happen because it'd be so funny. Just watching like old crankety Larry Brown drinking in the NEC for no reason. Like, why are you doing this, Larry?
Who hurt you?
Who hurt you? I think he like sold his soul and he's cursed to wander the sidelines for like the rest of his life. Like literally, he has to coach a basketball team.
Yeah. So Loyola Chicago, and I mean, we had some hindsight here. We hitched ourselves to this wagon as it was getting rolling.
I'd say we're still early on the Ramblers train.
Yeah, we were. This could be
the discovered. We were like, oh wow, this team's 10-1. How?
This could be the new Ramblin' wreck. So Loyola has more votes than we do in the AP poll.
Probably not unfair, to be honest.
Yeah, probably not unfair. And then they are. They have one less vote than us in the coaches poll. Since we last spoke,
destroyed Norfolk State.
Oh, wrecked.
80-52. I mean, look at that.
That's embarrassing. But
granted, Norfolk State 0-9. Not great.
Look at this, though.
Who was Norfolk State player that turned into an NBA player?
Oh,
that team that had a nice, I think they beat Mizzou in the first round of the tournament.
Yeah, the year that I was an idiot and I picked Mizzou to win it all.
How do you ever do that?
It was one of my worst bracket moments, admittedly, except for last season when that was the first time.
Well, apparently J.B. Smoove went there. Yeah. Tyler Quinn was the player on that team. Now New York Knicks great, Tyler Quinn.
14-13 New York Knicks.
True.
Yeah, looking like Loyola Chicago. Dan, we have ample opportunity to watch the Ramblers. They are on ESPN3 at bare minimum for each of like the next through the end of January. Every single game is on ESPN3 at the very least. There's two games on ESPNU, both against Northern Iowa.
If the Ramblers knock off Northern Iowa in one of these games, this team might have just as good a chance of making the tournament as Syracuse. I think Syracuse probably has a better chance just because like this team has no at-large hopes.
Really though, because they beat Florida.
That's true. I mean, they would have to. They would have to win the regular season, the MVC in the regular season, and then lose to like someone stupid in the final, and then also have a weak bubble.
Yeah, that's the problem. Like this doesn't remind me of like that Iona team that was an at-large a few years back. Or like that BYU team or a couple others. Like this does seem like a team that really needs to kind of, I mean, they beat Florida obviously, and then like, but they got smoked by Boise. They really have to kind of put their foot on the gas once they get into Horizon play. The Horizon?
They're MVC.
No, MVC. Sorry, that's MVC, right. They used to be. Used to be in the Horizon.
Yeah, they just moved up. They replaced Wichita. Yeah. Which MVC, like, super interesting lead now because all of these teams have moments. Like, I'm looking, the other teams in the league, Bradley, Evansville, who was pretty good last year, Northern Iowa, who's always pretty good, Valpo, who's often pretty good, Missouri State, not really, Southern Illinois, whatever, Drake, who, you know, he's good here and there, Indiana State's made the tournament a bunch recently. Illinois State's apparently fallen off big time, but they were, like, almost an at-large team last year.
They were senior laden last year, and, like, they were, I mean, I even wrote about them last year. Like, they were a fun team. Makes sense they dropped off a little bit. I don't know if you've seen the You've probably seen this. The Photoshop of Drake's logo with, like, Drake as the bulldog.
Yes, it's great.
Yeah, it is excellent. I really wish Drake was better at basketball. Because that one year they were was kind of fun.
Yeah, they were. I think like all those teams, except for like maybe Missouri State, have made the tournament, and they probably have too. I just haven't remembered it. But
yeah,
they're teams that make the tournament, and when they're good, like they can make some noise.
Missouri State is the team that I think has the highest RPI of a team ever left out of the field.
Yes,
that was like 06, 07.
Yeah, they had like 30. I think they had like 30 wins almost. Illinois State was similar last year.
Agreed. All right. So that's our mid-major update. We'll get more, well, low-major update. We'll get more to that in the weeks to come. Dan, it has been a pleasure, as always.
Thank you for having me, and hopefully we get a nice win this weekend and don't have our worst fears upheld.
Please, yes. That was Dan. I'm John. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Troy Noons as an Absolute Podcast. You can be sure to rate, review, subscribe, and go Orange.
Roll Tide.